All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Knicks? What's happening? Where are we at? How you feeling after the big long weekend? That strange disassociative weekend. It just starts on Wednesday or Thursday and it kind of smears on the calendar. You do the eating, you do the traveling. It's just a very weird time. I mean, I lost all sense of, you know, personal history, all sense of self-respect from the amount of food I ate, all sense of any kind of temporal. Is that the word I want? Temporal? Is that time? I just, you know, on top of the general weirdness post-COVID of time and the cultural malaise and shit show and just, you know, the climate weirdness, it just, everything becomes strange. And it's stranger when you just, you're floating in this Thanksgiving zone of long weekendness. And this thing goes on through Christmas. It's just, this is the weird time. Usually just mildly weird because it's kind of vacation, but it's kind of sad and it's kind of winter. I'm in LA, but still now it's just compounded by just a maelstrom of anti-Semitism and weirdness and just the general kind of like, what? When did the sky stop working? But let's not make it negative. How was your thing? Did you do a thing? I was very fortunate to bring food to another place, so it didn't stay in my house. I'm very fortunate not to have to look at a carcass and a pot of potatoes and way too much gravy and two different kinds of cranberry stuff and just wonder, like, how do we eat this all? How many days are going to take us to eat it? And should we throw it out? When can we throw it out? But I hope it went well for you. I hope everything worked out. Look, today on the show, I talk with Rob Delaney. I recorded it in London, as you remember, when I was there. You know Rob from the show Catastrophe and also his comedy and Deadpool and being one of the first big Twitter stars back in the day. Rob was on the show back in 2010, episode 55, one of our great early episodes. It was heavy, man. A lot has happened for Rob since then. He moved to London with his wife and his two young boys. And while they were living there, they had a third kid, Henry. But Henry passed away. And Rob just wrote a book called A Heart That Works about Henry's diagnosis of a brain tumor the 2 years leading up to his death and how Rob and his family dealt with their grief. Also, I've got a short talk with my friend Sam Lipsight to talk about his new novel, No One Left to Come Looking for You. Very funny. But let's get back to this Thanksgiving business. I cooked a brisket. I did a 10-hour smoke in the Traeger, and it came out pretty fucking good. I baked a chess pie, brought that over, with the stuffing, the amazing philosophy professor stuffing. The loaded stuffing, the stuffing full of baggage, the slightly traumatic, perhaps sexually inappropriate cost of that stuffing is something that I have stuck in my memory, but I've framed it and processed it and I'm left with stuffing and he's dead. But I did have a nice time, but I think that I'm a little tweaked. I've been pretty detached from like social media. Like I'm not the Twitter thing. It's odd. It didn't affect me that much. I don't use Twitter that much and I'm not that upset about it. I'd be more than happy for it to go. Instagram, I'm barely on that anymore. I check it occasionally. I'm limiting the email intake, you know, to mostly just my personal emails. And I'm just trying to clear my head to get into this special. I got to shoot the special on the 8th and I've only got 3 more shows to prepare for it. And this happens every time. I'm still not sure of how it's going to be structured. I need it to be fresh in my head. I need something new to happen. Like, I'd like to think that I'm not nervous about it. But look, man, I'm sucking down cigars. I'm eating everything in sight. I'm losing my fucking mind. I'm jacked up on caffeine. It feels like that I just need to kind of rev up my brain in a sort of mania / shame-driven depression business. Just this mishmash of emotions and feelings to avoid any sort of anxiety about the actual task at hand, which would cause anybody anxiety. But I just choose to fill in that world of possibilities of dread with a lot of other things so I can be like, nah, I'm pretty relaxed about the special. Look, you know, we've all been going through this in terms of with me. You know, I've been doing this material for a year and a half, and now we're going to do it. And it can only be an hour. and I'm sort of in this zone where it's like, I really need this cultural stuff to be in there, and I need this personal stuff to be in there. And it's just a matter of like finding the redundancies, trimming it down, weaving it together. And you would have thought I'd be working on that for the last year. But no, it really comes down to the wire with me. It's just the way I do it. So I've got these couple of shows coming up in Asheville, and then I've got the one in Nashville, and then I'm doing the thing. Got to figure out what shoes to wear. I got to figure out how to not wear clothing that I'll only wear that one day and regret wearing for the rest of my life. I cannot seem to land in an outfit on television that I like ever, ever. The last special, I don't know what I was thinking. The last special, I wore a vest and I wore a collarless shirt and these pants. It looked okay, but I was a little too skinny, and like I never wore the vest again because I don't know what I was thinking. The special before that, I wore some old ass chamois shirt, this red one that was like, that was very comfortable. And I'm like, I'm just going to wear stuff that I wear every day. It's like, no. It's a special. It's going to be around forever. Wear special things, but not new. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I got a stylist for this one to advise me. But I just bought these new pants, black jeans at Ship John, and these new t-shirts that he set me up with. And they look pretty fucking good. And maybe a Western style shirt. I don't know, dude. I think really what's going on is I just need to do this special. And I need a long break from hammering out the stand-up. And it's coming. And I've got plans. I don't know what you guys are doing for Christmas. But I'm going to go spend time with my father. I'm going to see my mother in between my Nashville show and my New York show. Do some family stuff. And just sort of do the life thing. It's so weird, man. You know, just talking, getting older, talking to people. I was talking to Tom Dreesen last night, who's been on the show. He's telling stories about old-timey show business. I'm hanging out with Tom Rhodes, who I hadn't seen in a while. You start to realize this is like, we're kind of the new older guys, and Dreesen's like the way older guy. He used to open for Sinatra. Told an amazing story about Sinatra and saving Johnny Carson's life. And I don't remember him telling me that story, but apparently it's in his book. Still Standing, I think it's called. But it was just so funny. It was me, Mo Mandel, my buddy Jerry Stahl, who had gone with me to the Comedy Store, and we're just standing around Tom, and he's telling these straight up fucking mob stories and all this Chicago stuff and this Vegas stuff. And it's just, there's not many of them left when show business was glorious and all the clubs were mob owned back in the day. You know, and I found myself at the Comedy Store the last couple nights doing a lot of parking lot time, just hanging out in the lot, talking to the young guys, talking to the old guys, getting ready to do my special, being a comic. So look, Sam Lipsyte is really one of my closest friends. And I have to be honest with you, this new book, No One Left to Come Looking for You, is a great, funny book. And it's a quick read because it just moves. And it's set on the Lower East Side in the music scene. And it's just so funny and so tight. And it's just, and there's a sort of a whodunit at the core of it. It's great. And it comes out, No One Left to Come Looking for You, comes out next Tuesday, December 6th. But you can pre-order it now wherever you get books. And this is me and Sam catching up. No One Left to Come Looking for Me.
For you. No One Left to Come Looking for You.
Oh, I blew it?
Yeah.
Damn it. No one Left to Come Looking for You.
Yeah.
Is that a riff on the Hillel thing or no?
It's quoted. It's a lyric from a song by the band Come.
If
you remember Come.
I don't remember Come, but it is a good window into the world we're talking about. No, you know the one. It's like when they came for the hoo hoos. You know, I said I'm not a hoo hoo when they came for the yayas.
Right. Yeah.
They said I'm not a yaya.
Yeah.
And then when they came for me,
There was no one.
No one left.
Yeah.
People like that used to be, I think, wrongly attributed to Einstein or something.
No,
like
it was a philosopher. Was it Hofstadter?
Hoffer? No, it was. I know who you mean. It was the theologian philosopher, right?
Niebuhr. Was it Niebuhr?
What was his name?
Yeah.
We'll have to.
Was it him, though? I don't think so.
No, I think it was always wrongly attributed. I don't know.
It's that guy Hoffer, I think. We have the technology just to look it up, right?
I've seen it attributed to 20 different people, is what I'm saying.
What? What do you want?
House cleaning?
What do you got? We're good. So by Martin Niemöller, German Lutheran pastor. Right. But that's not Niebuhr. What's his name? What's that guy?
Yeah, that was a thing with somebody else.
Doesn't matter. This is from the Cum lyric.
We should move back.
This is the Cum lyric.
We should,
from the band Cum.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with nothing, when they came for.
Nothing to do with the Jews or anybody else. although the leader of that band, or one of them, a woman named Talia Zedek.
Yeah. Was a Jew?
I think she is. I think so.
Oh, is a Jew.
But I'm not sure.
But the thing is, in terms of like this book is, and I've read a lot of your books, and I will say that I've read, I think, all of them except the one that you sent me on, and I got to read the short one. But I feel that the pace of this, like, you can't put it down. A lot of great characters. Good. There's a little bit of a detective story. There's points of reference in reality.
Yeah.
That was an interesting curveball about halfway through. And also, I feel like, you know, not unlike, like, so, look, I feel like you live part of this life. And I know that, like, it's not you. And honestly, dude, this time I didn't even picture you. I almost always picture you as the main guy.
Right. And the main guy is, you know, this kind of dumpy middle-aged guy.
Exactly.
Who's feeling the pressures of...
So it's easier to picture you like that?
Exactly.
But I didn't even picture a young Sam. I didn't picture a mulleted Sam.
Right, yes.
From his rock days.
A young, husky, mulleted Sam.
But not a mullet because of the mullet. I think it was just overcompensating for what you were losing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a party in the back and nothing in front.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's like, I still got something. Go fuck yourself.
And a defunct business in front.
It takes place in a very specific. It's
1993. It's the East Village. Yeah. I was in a band then. And this main character, his name is Jonathan Liptak, but he decides that he's going to be called Jack Shit.
Yeah.
Because he's in a band called The Shits.
Yeah.
And the novel begins. He wakes up one day and his roommate, who is the lead singer of the band and has a terrible drug problem, has disappeared with Jack Shit's bass.
Yeah.
Jack Shit is the bass player. And he's pretty convinced that he's taken the bass to sell for drugs.
Right.
And so the novel takes place over a few days as he's searching for his lead singer and his bass.
Yeah.
And it takes him deeper and deeper into some mysteries and some murder. And so it becomes a kind of like detective novel of sorts that also includes sort of figures of the time, some of whom became even more powerful as time went on.
Yes, it involved the New York machine,
the New York
political machine.
There's the New York political machine. There's the police of that, you know, of that neighborhood.
The drugs of that neighborhood.
There are the drugs and the drug dealers. So there's a lot going on, and he's sort of, Jack Shit is our guide through it.
But it's hilarious because you have to really sort of construct a music scene out of what was sort of like, you know, just I guess like no wave was probably about that time, or was it everything was shifting?
Yeah, everything was shifting.
Alt-rock.
It was just before Nirvana hit,
right,
and then right after Nirvana.
So everything
sort of straddling that period of time.
Yeah,
that they're in. That's when I was there.
Yeah,
and the thing that was interesting that I mean I think about this a lot, about living there and living in any kind of congested area like that, is there are probably, you know, 100 music scenes happening on top of each other, unaware of each other.
Yes.
So like you're in your little circuit with your bands, your friends, the clubs you play on certain nights, where you practice, the bars you hang out in, the apartments you hang out in. And, you know, then you like are walking down the street and you see flyers for some other bands And, you know, they're in the same neighborhood you are, playing the same places, but you're kind of like, I don't know anything about that.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And like, I have my world. Yeah. I have my little, you
know. It's true. And that, yeah. But there was only a certain, there's only a few cities that that could happen in.
Yeah, right.
And this was one of
them. This was one of them.
And also, you just have the crashing waves of everything that came before in New York.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, the original punks, performance art,
right.
You know, new wave, no wave, art, music.
Well, that these characters in this book are very much aware of how they're, I think the Yiddish word is nachschleppers. They're, you know, the ones who've come after. They're sort of they're too late in some ways. You know,
right.
Punk came and went.
Right.
You know, they're in a kind of post-punk age.
Right.
But what does that mean? And it's New York. You know, what does it mean to be in New York? And now they're kind of almost the first wave of these gentrifying people. And they're like, there are people in the novel talking about that a lot.
Right. And also about, like, you know, the band that sold out that in there, getting all the attention.
And then there's the band that like signs to Geffen, and like our narrator is very, he's both incredibly, you know, bitter about them. He also kind of secretly thinks they're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't want to admit that to anyone.
But one of the best details of it is the guy who has the band that almost everyone has been in.
Yeah. Right.
That to me is such a detail of a music scene, of any music scene,
right.
Everybody has passed through that guy's band.
Yeah.
And it still exists in some form.
Yeah, it's his band at this point. And
that's so funny.
That band is called The Annihilation of the Soft Left.
A lot of good names, a lot of good funny. But so with this book, though, like, what were the decisions you made? Like, how is it different? Because, like, do you think it's because it is such familiar terrain that it just, like, the pace of it is different? But you're...
No, well, my last book was pretty, it was a long book, and there were a lot of different voices.
Hark.
And there were different POVs in it. I would switch characters, and it was, you know, it was multi-voiced, let's put it that way. In this book, I just knew I wanted it to be this one narrator, and take place in a few days and just be very contained and really I was thinking about that time. I wrote most of this during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I actually bought a couple of notebooks and I had this like cheap fountain pen and I just wrote it that way and like didn't even look at the computer for a long time and just said
you wrote it by hand.
I said I have to write a whole draft by hand before I put anything into the computer.
That was your idea?
And I just wanted to like get down to that was the ritual. I wanted to get to the real physicality of writing this book and staying in this book. It's all in like a couple notebooks and the first draft
really.
And and I was really, those memories, you know, it all changes in the book and it's not, the book is not my story or the story of my band, but the feel of being alive in that time and place, I was very connected to it while I was writing the book. And each day I would just, you know, find myself just descending into that sense of being like 24. And I was having to channel my, you know, really kind of both, you know, very alive and very dumb 24-year-old head to like to get there.
It's so funny too that like descriptions of everything and the drugs and his like you know the bodega thing. Yeah. It's such a fucking like it's a New York novel, but it's not the kind you really, you know, I've never seen one like this. And you wrote it all on paper. Do you think that the idea of writing in notebooks connects you to something more personal because it is sort of a way of journaling in a sense?
Maybe. I mean, I also, it also connects me to like, to me, writing is even though we don't think of it this way, is a very physical act.
Yeah.
And the more sometimes I can, at least for me, I can get in touch with the physicality of, you know, using ink to put down, to make these symbols on a page in a certain order to evoke feeling in other people. Like that's, you know, that's a thing I'm doing with my body as well as my mind,
right.
Or they're one thing,
really, yeah.
And it's sort of one process. And so that was very useful for me to just get this draft, that first draft done, and to feel that I could just tap into this one flow for the whole.
Right, but isn't that sort of like a, like almost like this weird Kerouacian trip where you don't have access to cutting and pasting.
He was writing on this
I'm just saying editorially, like that.
I wasn't. I was editing as I went. I wasn't
right,
not
but you yeah. weren't but things weren't going in the trash. You like right. in the sense of yeah. like when you're editing as you go along on a computer, you can literally excise things and they disappear forever.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, here you just have to cross it out.
Yeah, but it still exists.
It still exists as this crossed out page. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's good.
Yeah.
That means you're completely responsible for your train of thought without the access of computer-enabled decision-making, which takes you out of a flow. Like, you can make decisions on the computer which completely upend whatever your real train of thought was because you can just move shit around.
Right. I mean, one of my favorite writers, who I know you like a lot, Stanley Elkin,
yeah.
He was middle-aged by the time the word processor really became something yeah. that people could use. And he said, oh, well, everyone should be able to write a perfect novel at this point.
Right. With that thing. Right. That's the way he saw it.
Yeah.
I wonder if he, did he use one?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, but yeah?
He called it his bubble machine.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I honestly thought this book, like, ended solid.
Yeah.
Like, the third act was great. Like, you know, it's satisfying.
Oh,
you know?
God, thank you. I'm glad.
Yeah, because that's a hard one, right? How do you land this thing?
The landing it is really hard sometimes.
Right? Because yeah. you got all this stuff like building up to it. How do you make those kind of decisions? Like, because, you know, it's a very weird thing about endings in novels. I can't imagine the struggle of that.
Well, it's funny because I knew, you know, I threw these things into motion in the beginning that yeah. they had, you know, the show coming
up. That's it. You also had to solve a caper.
I had to solve a caper. It's very Scooby-Doo in a way. They solve the caper. Mm-hmm. They have a show, and then they have a show to play.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I knew that couldn't be the end. There had to be this other little coda.
Right. Right.
And that had to, so like, you know, I always sometimes have, you know, I think of this as a circle.
Yeah.
But it doesn't meet.
Yeah.
The two ends don't meet.
Yeah.
One kind of goes off.
Right, 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 right.
And that's sort of how you want to think about your ending.
So like, right.
Just veering off a little bit.
But on some level, the circle completes, but it doesn't, yeah. it doesn't become a whole circle.
Exactly.
There's some other yeah, thing that exactly, shoots over yeah, here.
Exactly.
Like, where's that going?
Yeah.
To try another circle?
Right, exactly. It's going over to yeah. Bleak to yeah. start a new circle.
Yeah, to start over again. But when you were like, because I thought it was all very, I guess, visceral is the word, because I could picture all these people from down there on the Lower East Side, because I lived there between A and B. So I was like, I could see all of it.
Right.
Yeah, but that's where you were hanging out too, right?
Yeah, that's exactly where I lived.
You lived, what street you live
on? I lived a couple different places, but yeah, Avenue B.
Yeah.
9th Street.
Wow. 10th Street. Jeez, man. So what happens? Is it going to be a movie?
Oh, I not that I know of, unless...
Well, it has to come out first, I guess.
Yeah. I think it would be a very good movie.
It'd be great.
Yeah.
It'd be a great movie. Okay, so do you want to pitch it? You don't need me, though. You can do it on your own. Just call your agent. It's not a TV show. You don't need me. You already wrote it.
I think it's a TV show.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, maybe a limited...
Miniseries?
Miniseries, yeah. I mean... It's a movie.
You're on a roll, dude.
It's, yeah, well, like, you know.
Yeah, you're thinking ahead. Sam Lipsight, people. No One Left to Come Looking for You comes out next Tuesday, December 6th. Pre-order it now. Funny book, good book, tight book, beautifully written book. We'll have more of me and Sam posting this week for Full Marin subscribers. Plenty left. Go to the link in the episode description to subscribe to WTF Plus or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus to get all that stuff. Now, let's go back to England. I did a few interviews in England. I interviewed Rob Delaney, Armando Iannucci, Courtney Love, Tommy Tiernan. And I guess this is the second of the UK conversations. I was actually in Ireland when I interviewed Tommy, but me and Rob caught up. Me and Rob go back. The difference between Rob's life now and Rob's life when I first talked to him is profound and a beautiful success story, but also a tragic, horrible event occurred that he had to process, which we talk about it, the loss of his son. And the book, A Heart That Works, comes out tomorrow, November 29th.
You can get it wherever you get books. And this is me catching up and really talking about grief and loss, among other things, with Rob Delaney.
Yeah, we might as well just get on the mics and regroup. What do you think of
terrific.
That?
Yeah, you very good happy about to. It? Yeah, nice to be holding a mic, too, like an American.
When was the last time you fucking held a mic?
Well, I haven't done much stand-up post-pandemic because I've been fortunate to be doing a lot of acting work, yeah. And I have young kids,
yeah.
And I, after Henry's death, I don't... you know, I massively prioritize family time. So I would love to be doing more stand-up, but now with the book
right.
and acting, haven't done right. as much. But
right.
I was doing a shitload up until the pandemic.
Really?
But I've only been on stage. Yeah, no, the reason I specified I'm happy to be holding a mic is because I've been doing things where projection was necessary for the last few months, but it's always like a British head mic where come on, I want to hold my... gun, you know what I mean? So
I didn't know there was a thing, a British head mic.
Mm-hmm.
You mean the TED Talk mic?
Yeah, the TED Talk mic.
The wraparound mic?
Yeah, Brits love that. They'll do stand-up in one of those.
Yeah,
Jesus.
It always looks odd to me. It looks yeah. like, I always feel like that you're sort of expected to do magic
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, a little trick. Pull a rabbit out of your hat.
But I was looking at the I haven't talked to you.
It's been a long time.
2010.
Is that true?
Is that fucking nuts?
That's distressing.
That's when that podcast, when we did that podcast.
My Lord.
But I don't feel like distant from you.
No, I'm very abreast of all that you do. In fact,
you're familiar to me.
Yeah, The Bad Guys is on heavy rotation in our house. That's you're right. so good in that. Thank Christ Mark Maron is doing cartoons because your voice is so just glorious.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's so good.
I was funny because with that, I was the only... I've drinking 9 Americanos. I have no
oh,
sense.
Oh, terrific.
I have no sense of...
I've had 4.
You have...
just 4.
I don't know. I miss drip coffee. It starts to depress me. When I get here, I'm like, I can't take any more espresso.
Yeah. It's funny. So I've lived here for 8 years now, and people sometimes, if you go somewhere, whatever, some holding room or whatever, and they're like, oh, apologies, the coffee's not that good. I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'm American. I'll drink garbage. Is it brown? Let's have it, you know?
But it's still espresso.
Sometimes, yeah.
I can't find a drip coffee. But yeah, so I'm sweating because I have no way to calibrate how much of this I need.
Yep. Well, you're among brethren.
2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you were, you know, you hadn't done anything, really.
No, nobody knew who I was, certainly.
And you were, like, you know, brooding and weird a little bit, were you? I mean, I remember we talked about the horrendous alcoholic bottom hitting and the driving the car. But, I mean, you were doing stand-up. You were doing the Twitter thing.
Yeah.
I guess you weren't depressed, but it was a heavy talk, and it resonated forever.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a nickel, you know. I mean,
is that what it was?
Oh, yeah, I was sharing a car with my wife, and you know, she was teaching. She was the breadwinner. Culver City Middle School,
right,
as an English teacher.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm taking the bus her car to go do stand up.
Right,
making less than unemployment. You know, the things where
during
like
UCB.
Oh, certainly.
That was like it wasn't like you weren't doing the big clubs.
No.
We were just doing. That was when alternative comedy was a thing.
Yeah.
But it didn't go anywhere. It's all gone now.
Oh, God.
All of it. All the Bringer shows. Everything's gone.
Lord.
I think. I don't know. I am old.
Yeah,
and I have no idea what people are doing.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's interesting. You know, and then because now that I had even had 2 kids before anybody really knew who I was because of catastrophe.
Yeah.
And which is great. I mean, how great to only have people learn who you are after you've been sober for some time.
Yeah.
So you don't go bananas.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like I just bought some plane tickets to go home to Boston. And
how often do you go?
I've been going a lot lately.
Who's there still?
Everybody.
You folks are still alive?
My dad is dying. Mm. He's got leukemia and is on his way out. So I've been there a lot lately.
Yeah.
And we've been having a really good time.
Yeah.
I you know, I think about death, talk about death, and lately witness it a lot lately. But with my dad, it's sort of different because the amount of quality time that we have spent together lately has been amazing. He was a huge part of my son Henry's life. He became proficient in and certified in taking care of a little tiny kid, you know, 1 and then 2, with a complex tracheostomy, so he could do emergency care and airway maintenance.
Was he here?
Yeah.
So he came.
He came here a lot. He was the only one of the four grandparents who was retired. So they were all amazing and came when they could. But my dad would come for months
and got certified as a caregiver. For a child. With cancer.
And so he was so great. So I don't want him to die because I love him and I love spending time with him. But God damn it, his final innings were glorious. And I'm so proud of him and so grateful for him. So he, I'm going to go there and get in bed with him and hug him and put my head on his chest. And it's weird, you know, because I've had a son die. I don't, as I said, I don't want my dad to die, but I'll pull through. You know what I mean? And I've just been able to focus on loving him.
Well, that's, I mean, well, the title of the book, you know, Heart That Works, I you know, is a, it seems like a fine metaphor for a life that you know, eventually lands
in
the right place.
Let us also, Mark Maron, acknowledge that that's from a lyric by Juliana Hatfield from Boston. And the full lyric being "a heart that hurts is a heart that works." And the second I heard that on WFNX in Boston, I was like, oh, look, my life mantra has arrived.
So that was always part of the rotation of songs in your head since you were a kid?
For sure.
Really?
Yeah. Not. I mean, I don't. I wonder how old I was. I should look up how old I was when that came out.
Yeah.
I probably had pubic hair.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, I mean, I was trying to kind of wrap my brain around the trajectory, because I guess when I first talked to you, how sober were you really?
If it was 2010, then I had been sober for 8 years.
Yeah.
And now it's 20.
And you also had, you know, problems with, you know, darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That you
Yeah. Serious depression. Because, you know, I don't have a medical degree. I'll never get one. But, you know, I think I was one of those self-medicators. And after my fairly climactic getting sober, which, you know, I drove a car into a building and then was in jail. So I was quite busy in early sobriety between surgeries, court dates, rehab. Yeah. And so I had a lot to do.
Yeah.
And as soon as the smoke started to clear and I remained sober for a calendar
year. And your wife stuck with you through, like, she
we hadn't met yet.
Oh, okay.
We hadn't met. We met. I got sober in 2002. We met in 2004.
The new guy. She met the new guy.
Big time. And so my brain was like, wait a minute. All right. Now that your arms have been surgically knit, now that you're employable just about, you're going to start getting loaded again, right? And I was like, no, I'm not. And my brain was like, oh, well, then fuck off. It just absolutely stopped working. So real serious depression, you know, with physical components, you know, thrumming pain, diarrhea, vomiting. I mean, like, awful.
Just from the mental thing.
It was really bad. And so but talk therapy and antidepressants worked for me, thank God.
And do you continue both of those?
I do, yeah. I think maybe one day when my kids are adults, I might, you know, see about maybe reducing it, but I don't want, I'm in no rush. You know what I mean?
Like, I mean, if it works, it works, right?
Yeah.
So because, like, you know, I kind of lost track of, you know, of you, but I mean, I just know there was a point where, you know, you were here. And you had a hit show and you were just gone. You were not in America anymore. And you were a phenomenon in Britain. And I was like, well, good for him.
Crazy, right?
But I mean, that show was huge.
We were really lucky, you know.
Catastrophe.
We were so lucky. Because I think we wrote that pilot and neither of us
How did you know her?
I met her on Twitter probably around 2010.
Wow.
And I had seen a show of Sharon's called Pulling, which I thought was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And so I wrote her and said, hey, crazy about your show. And she's like, oh, cool. And but then we became friends. And, you know, then a couple years later, we thought, hey, let's write a pilot together. We did. And we weren't spring chickens. We weren't trying to... you know, it wasn't pilot season, so we weren't like, we need to get out this year's idea. We were just like, let's write from our hearts. And so we wrote kind of a wild, bare bones, domestic, high octane, tight little thing. And it costs nothing to make, so I don't think it was like a big risk, you know? And then people were like, wow, I guess this is all right, you know?
This is great. And it's cheap.
Yeah. So, like, I tell people in America how much an episode of Catastrophe costs to make, and they're like, you're kidding, right?
Right. Because
there's no special effects, you know?
Sure. And there's like, I mean, I talked to Armando Iannucci yesterday, and I think just the nature of production here is so much different in terms of how many people are involved, the infrastructure of the business here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everything's different here. And this sort of, you know, like it seems that three or four seasons is enough to a British people.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sharon and I wrote every episode, and we, you know, I had a child die. And
but that was during the show?
It was in between the third and fourth season. So yeah, I didn't know that I would make a fourth.
But he was sick during three.
So we make one and two.
Yeah.
Back to back right after moving here. And then he gets sick. And
he was born here, Henry?
Yeah, he was.
And the other two were born in the States?
Yeah, the first two were born in the U.S.
How old are they now?
11 and 9.
And then you have another one, too.
Yeah,
right?
Who's four, and he was also born here. So I got two who were born at UCLA Santa Monica, and then two who were born here in London. And
they would be British citizens, yeah?
No, not quite. Here's a fun thing. America, I mean, I know we love to lambaste it as xenophobia headquarters, but in fact, if you're born in America, it doesn't matter what, you get an American passport. You're born here, they're like, oh, we don't care.
Yeah.
So even my son who was born here, they're like, yeah, you're American, buddy. And he has to go through all the hoops.
Really?
Which we're going through. We're almost citizens.
For what? For British citizenship?
Yeah. So they're
like,
no, man.
Going to be a dual citizenship?
Yeah, we would be dual citizens.
And it's taken this long to do that? Or is it that long a process? Or
you it just is. It takes a while. You know, I mean,
can't you just say I had a TV show?
Well, in fact, yes. When we were very lucky and we won BAFTAs for comedy writing for Catastrophe, then that kicked my visa up to like what they call an exceptional talent visa.
Really?
Which can last longer than your shitty cobbled together 6 month visas because you came over to do stand up.
Right.
So. Honestly, when we got the BAFTA, I was like, hey, a BAFTA's cool, but I also got a big fat visa. And that was like awesome. Because then I didn't have to go to the home office in Croydon every 6 months with a bunch of children and spend the day with bureaucrats.
So are you happier here?
No, we tried to leave, in fact. No, don't get me wrong. I love it here, but it wasn't like, you know, I just feel more comfortable here. This is more suited to the United Kingdom. Yeah. No. We wanted, after two series of Catastrophe, my wife was like, hey, what do you say we move back to Santa Monica where we can walk from our front door literally into the ocean, turn around, face the shore, and look at the Santa Monica Mountains? Wouldn't that be nice?
And they're on
like,
fire now.
Yeah. So. And it was like, I know, right? But at the time, they were merely smoldering. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. So we were going to move back. And then the second we made that decision, Henry got diagnosed with a brain tumor. So we couldn't leave. So, of course, we'll go back through this if you want. But the basic timeline is in between seasons two and three of Catastrophe, we went to move back. Henry got diagnosed. And then we couldn't go anywhere because he began care. You're not going to fly a kid who's just had his brainstem opened up. So time passes. We get used to getting care here. Our older boys' school is wonderful to them, and the people we barely know, many of them are taking great care of us.
Yeah.
The NHS here was amazing. So then he's sick for 21 months, and then he dies. And when he died, we were really immobile. You know, we couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
And time continued to pass, even though we were grieving. So by this time, years have passed, and our older boys, who we love just as much as Henry, don't want to move. And we're like,
they're dug in.
Yeah. They're like, well, that makes sense. So
I guess that's what it's about ultimately. If you can, you know, honor the kids, then you do it.
Yeah. Well, so there's, you know, six of us. One of them has departed this realm, but we try to make decisions as a, you know, I guess maybe I was going to say a democracy, but I guess my wife and I are the senators. Yeah. So our votes do count for a little bit more, but we very seriously consider what the kids have to say. So we do try to think of it as what's best for the six people as a whole.
So it took you, I mean, you know, the process of grief and the process of sort of reckoning with your own feelings. I mean, it took you a while to embark on a memoir around this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're considering the book, I mean, what is your reason?
Okay. So at first,
is this something you've answered many times?
No. Oh. At first, I wanted to write something very angry and even hateful. And I wanted
towards who?
The world, who people who haven't experienced terrible grief, people who aren't roiling in pain.
So you felt that people did not know how to handle it on any level,
right?
And that even, you know, loved ones, friends, regular, mm-hmm, and passing.
Yes.
So the I guess the initial feelings of anger that, yeah, that cannot be explained.
Yeah.
You know, having dealt with a bit of tragedy myself, that, yeah, you know, I realized relatively quickly I was not in the same position you were, but you know, somebody, you know, I love died quickly.
Yeah.
And it was tragic, and it was, yeah, unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But I mean, even the word unnecessary is a ridiculous word.
Mm-hmm.
Because from my experience, I realized it, just in order to keep my sanity, that, you know, sadly, this isn't unusual. It's,
right,
not unusual. You just don't want it to happen to you.
Right. Yeah.
So like the initial anger at God, yeah, or the injustice, or, yeah, why, like, let's, instead of talk about the inception of the book, I mean, when he was diagnosed.
Yeah.
What was the feeling? Was the first feeling like, well, we're gonna fix it. We're gonna do everything we can to fix it.
Yeah. So we had some weeks where we couldn't figure out what it was, because when you've just turned one and you can't talk, nobody immediately thinks brain tumor. You know, the thing that,
so terrible. I'm so, yeah, sorry you had to go through this.
Well, thank you. The thing. The thing that, like, made an older doctor, and I think this is important, because we knew we were meeting wonderful young doctors and, yeah, nurses, but I think this guy had just been around the block, mm-hmm, and he said to me, he goes, so he's vomiting a lot. And I said, yeah, which is clear, you know, it was terrifying because he's a baby,
yeah,
who's supposed to be chunking up,
yeah,
and he's losing weight,
yeah,
and disappearing. So that was awful. I used to want to collect his vomit and then pour it in a funnel back down his, I mean, yeah, his vomit was like more precious than gold to, yeah, me, and I would cry. And so a doctor says to me, you know, I don't know how many doctors we'd have seen at this point, he goes, let me ask you something, when he vomits, does he retch, you know, does he seem in distress,
yeah,
or is it effortless? And I was like, it's effortless. It, yeah, just comes up and out.
Yeah.
You know, there's no retching or, yeah, you, yeah, know, yeah, heaving, yeah, or anything.
Right.
And he goes, okay, then we need to do an MRI of his head. And I was like, what? Why?
Yeah.
And the reason being is that effortless vomiting can be a symptom of a brain tumor, because what happens is the pressure in your head just presses on the emetic center, the vomit button.
Yeah.
So you just, bloop, and, yeah, just up and out with the contents, ugh, of your stomach.
Jesus.
So when he said that, I was like, that's what it's going to fucking be, isn't it? And it was. And so,
how old are your other kids at this time?
3 and 5.
And you're working your ass off.
Luckily, I'm just in between 2 and 3. So I do have a little breathing room.
But all in all, like, leading up to this, you know,
then I'd been working like a madman,
and, yeah, and you were feeling, you know, I mean, because I know that, you know, as an alcoholic person,
mm-hmm,
you know, that you're going to, yeah, find something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it seems like, I mean, was your wife working?
No. So it was very difficult because we moved here with a 3 and a 1-year-old. She's, yeah, pregnant with Henry when we arrive.
Mm.
She takes a leave of absence from Culver City Middle School.
Yeah.
And we don't know anybody. So she's lonely. I'm working round the clock, and I'm being a bad husband. I'm really working crazy hours. I think anybody could like look at what I was doing and how I was doing it and be like, I get it. You know, I thought like, this is my shot. This mm-hmm. is my opportunity to
sure.
swing yeah. for the fences.
Yep.
And so I thought I had to do everything. And that I don't know that that's ever true, that you have to do everything. You know, you what I did was after the second series, my wife said to me, so listen, I'm pretty miserable with the amount that you're working
yeah.
and the dire lack of attention you're giving to me and the kids.
Yeah.
So I've been looking into how to divorce you while in a foreign country. It's not going to be easy, but I think I figured out how to do it. Unless that is, you want to change how you work and the amount that you work, and then maybe we can work things out.
Yeah.
And that stopped me in my tracks. I wasn't like...
I hope she said it in that tone.
Yeah, right. Very calmly. And so that immediately, my response really was, okay, I will make those changes.
Yeah.
I do love you. I do love these kids. At risk of losing this show, I will do those things. And it wasn't easy. I mean, I felt like I was on fire, you know.
Were you mad?
There was anger, not really at her, because if you look at, I mean, like, I'll show you a picture of her. She's beautiful. She's got three beautiful children that look like her, mostly, slightly me, but not really. Yeah. And so she, it's a vision. You know, I look at her, it's the there's nothing more beautiful to me than those people. And so I want them to be happy. I want them to feel good. Yes, I also want people to be clapping for me and saying, what a magnificent show you've made.
And you
want to
make money, too.
And I want to make money. But I realized, what do I want more? I want them to know peace for a few minutes of each day, if possible.
Yeah.
And so I decided to try to learn how to work smarter and not harder. And I realized, because I realized, what do I care about in a TV show?
Sure.
I'll tell you what I care about. I care about that each script lands with a thump on the table,
right,
is airtight, and that when you read it, you have a full, mature, nourishing entertainment experience.
And you were writing it, so you could...
and you can picture it all, and you hope it gets made, because you think it'll... But if it doesn't, you had a good experience reading it. That's what I care about. Do I care what the characters are wearing? No. Well, no,
that's not
I don't.
Your job, really.
No. Do I care about the locations they're shooting in? No, I really don't.
Yeah.
Can I be funny in that location? Then I don't care.
Right.
So what I did was I dropped all the other stuff and was like, oh, why don't I let our amazing heads of department do their jobs?
So you surrendered the control freak.
Exactly.
Element.
Right. I remained despotic, as did Sharon, about the scripts.
Right.
You know, beyond that, have a blast, DOP, with your lens selection.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
So
that's a good lesson to learn.
So that was amazing. Yeah. That freed up a lot of time.
Yeah. And, to be able to do that, to be able to, what's the word that I always forget,
is delegate.
It's a gift.
Alcoholic forgetting the word delegate. I love it.
it's one of those words that sticks with me every time where I'm like, hey, is it sub to but all right, so now this is where you're at before Henry gets it,
right?
These are decisions
that joke. It isn't even certainly not a month. It might not have even been weeks from that conversation with my wife where I'm like, it's overhaul time. Do it, embark on the barest beginnings of that,
right?
And then Henry is diagnosed.
So he gets a scan.
Yeah.
And is there any hope?
Yes. Because, okay, I mean, honestly, now you look at it and you're like, I don't know. Like any you know, doctor would be like, wow. The tumor was called an ependymoma, and he was so young and a boy, which are the worst. If you're young, really young and male, ependymoma, they don't get me wrong. They kill little girls too, but they kill more little boys. And so he was like in the worst cohort to get it. But it was possible that they could take it all out and he'd be disabled. But it was possible that it wouldn't come back, but it did. And
they took it out?
Yeah, they took it out. They did a good job. The surgery was brutal because they had to damage his brainstem. They had to damage and even destroy some cranial nerves to get it out, meaning, you know, so his half his face was immediately paralyzed. His ability to swallow was gone, so he had to get a tracheostomy.
And that would have been life. It would have been, he would not, had he lived.
Oh, as you get... As your body just increases in size, they can give you less horrific tracheostomy tubes, ones where you could even put a speech valve on it. And it was possible that he might have regained. There are people who've had his cancer, had a tracheostomy, and then gotten older and had the tracheostomy removed. So that could have happened.
But it's interesting, you know... It seems, I don't have children, and it's probably, you know, I don't know why, but because I can't even handle hearing about this, the panic and the worry and the pain, that you know, whatever your love for that kid is at that time, you're willing to accommodate the idea that he's going to live this horrendously compromised life and still believe that that life is worth fighting for.
Oh, big time. Oh, no. So, you know what's funny is my wife and I met back in 2004 at a camp in Massachusetts for people with disabilities called Camp Jabberwocky.
Yeah.
And so we met taking care of disabled adolescents through adults with major disabilities and problems. And, you know, so we're doing feeding tubes and wiping butts and, you know, lifting, you know, paralyzed adults and all sorts of stuff. And so, so... We had a bunch of friends who were quite disabled already, and so and had been around people like that and loved people like that. So,
so this is you met her before you went to Hollywood, and then that came back around.
No, I left Los Angeles just for a summer. There, so this camp,
after you got sober.
Yeah, I met a guy. A sober guy. And he said to me, "Hey, you know, I'm doing this camp in Venice, California. That is." For people with disabilities, it's sort of a satellite of a camp I've worked at for years in Massachusetts. Do you want to come work at it, you know, volunteer at it? And I was like, yeah, I would love to. So I did that. I had the best time ever.
So this is like service.
Yeah, I guess, you know. And but it's fun. That's the secret. That's the dirty secret of volunteering is it's usually fun as hell.
Yeah.
So people who enjoy things like drugs or gambling or watching Succession would probably also, if they got off their ass, enjoy volunteering too. That's the secret. And so, so then I went back to the one in Massachusetts for just for a couple weeks, you know, because I had some time off. And so I went and it happened to meet my wife at that time. So I, although I grew up in Massachusetts, I wasn't living there when I met my wife. I was just visiting to volunteer at
and
this
camp.
And
where was she from?
She was in the process. She's from Asheville, North Carolina. And she was in the process at the time where she had been teaching in Mississippi. And she was in the process of moving to D.C. So she was homeless for a few weeks as she moved. And so she did this camp. So we were just both in transient periods, met each other, and fell in love. But here's the thing. It's almost like you start taking care of your child who's disabled, and no, it's not easy. Yes, your house becomes like a satellite hospital.
But how do you how triage? Do you, isn't there a sort of persistent heartbreak?
Of course, there's difficult. But you know what? To be honest, is Henry died before he turned three?
Right.
Right. So Henry died before he was cognizant of the fact that he was different and that there were things that he couldn't do or couldn't do as well. So Henry was like, hey, what's up, man? I'm Henry. Let's party.
And also, like, I don't know, like, because I'm, you know, selfish and I don't have children, like, I'm speculating. And it seems like, you know, in my mind, if we continue how I'm thinking about it, that it'd be like, well, we should just let him die. You know what I mean?
Well, here's the thing is, like, one thing that I realized from doing this camp is that after you spend a bunch of time, like we're like a bunch of like sleep cycles, wake up, go to sleep, and people with people who are quote disabled and people who are quote not, the line really begins to blur. So like if you're literally like, you know, in a camp situation with people, then like, you know, like whatever, like, you know, evening will roll around and you'll be thinking like, oh, I'd really rather hang out with Nancy right now, who's quite disabled, you know, speaks using a board where she points at words, than I would with Dave, who's another counselor, fully able-bodied, but a bit of a weird asshole.
Yeah.
So you find yourself like, you realize like, you kind of forget who's disabled and who isn't. The spirit starts to, or you, not starts to shine through, but you get to where you can see it faster in people. So like, you look, you can have fun and laugh and have a robust emotional experience with somebody with Down syndrome, just like you can with somebody who doesn't.
Of course. I have no doubt about that. It's just like the spectrum of, it's that the spectrum of your life. You personally, was you were already, you know, somewhat, you know, open-hearted to at least the human experience on it. That's
getting sober certainly helped a lot.
So after the first surgery, what was the hope?
That the cancer would not return,
right?
And that over a lot of time, he would begin to work through and heal from, if possible, damage to his brainstem, and so, yeah, we just hoped cancer wouldn't return and that he would outgrow or heal from or repair stuff that so he could get rid of the tracheostomy.
And how are the other kids handling it? Are they old enough to register?
They're over. They're in the hospital all the time. I mean, we have hundreds of pictures of the three of them in the hospital bed, you know, having eaten McDonald's.
So you had the other kid while he was still sick?
No. Our youngest came after.
Right. Okay,
my wife was pregnant when Henry died with our fourth. So that little fella did not get to meet Henry in the traditional sense, you know, although he shared a womb with him. And then he was in Henry's bedroom. It became his room.
Now, in terms of healthcare, you had a great experience here.
Yeah, we really did. You know, I think it's an important distinction to make, you know, because I love to criticize not American health care, but American private health insurance.
Right.
Obviously, there's amazing nurses and doctors in the United States, and you can get great care. There's no question about that. But the question is, you know, can you access it? And in accessing it, are you going to go bankrupt or insane, you know, more likely from trying to navigate all the labyrinths of private health insurance. So the big benefit for us is that we had more time with our son. I spent no time in the hallway on the phone with the insurance company saying he needs this MRI.
Right.
Please approve it.
Yeah.
You know, or I didn't spend time arguing with a pharmacist because they understandably couldn't understand the crazy new terms of the pharmacy plan that we were on,
and,
you know, so they're not asking me for $615 for a prescription that he needs to live, you know?
Yeah.
So the amount of, we had less stress than an American would, in dealing with this. So we had more time and didn't get a perforated ulcer from stress. So really beautiful.
And when do you start to realize, I'm assuming that, you know, given what we talked about earlier in terms of the, you know, what drove you to write the book in after the fact, that when do you start to feel alone in your dealing with the tragedy in terms of, I mean, obviously the family was close, and I assume that, you know, your family, but when do you start to realize that people have no real emotional sense of how to deal with it, or you?
Well, I must say, it's not everybody, as you may have experienced yourself, that you can be surprised by certain
surprised.
People who step up beautifully.
Totally.
And then other people who you think would have been there fuck off and do a terrible job.
Well, I guess I assume nobody would. I mean, I didn't really know. You know, my parents are not emotionally capable people, so they were not great.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, it happened so quickly.
Yeah.
But in terms of our community, the comedians, I mean, it was kind of stunning.
That's wonderful. That's so great.
And it was the middle of COVID, so it was kind of limited in and of itself. Like you know, so you kind of take what you could get.
Yeah.
But some people, I mean, it was really amazing. So, what was your experience?
So a lot of people were wonderful.
Yeah.
A lot of people surprised us in beautiful ways. Plus, we're in a country where we do not have roots, you know? And so a lot of people were great. But then some people are afraid of you. You know, if you lose a child, I think, you know, as they say, losing a child is people who have children's greatest fear. And so I think people were afraid of us. That's my guess. That's my stab at it, is that they were afraid of us, that they might catch dead kid from us, or they'd have to imagine, you know,
right.
Dead
I
kid.
Think that's probably more it, the mortality of their own life or their own children.
Yeah.
That the, I've been trying to talk about grief for a while with people, you know, and again, you know, I don't want to, you know, compare griefs or whatever, but you know, the feeling is the feeling that, that loss.
Yeah.
And it is so human.
Yeah.
Unavoidable. But I understand what you're saying, because I was thinking back on, I know a guy who lost a kid in a car accident, and we weren't close or anything, but there's that feeling of like, what do you even say?
Yeah.
And I guess that is selfish, because what I learned in talking about this stuff on stage is that sometimes all you got to do is stand there.
Exactly. The question, I think, isn't what do I say? It's better is what do I do?
Right.
Because you're, you know, Marc Maron, multiple stand-up specials, you know, you're good at talking. But nobody is so good at talking that they can heal the pain of death.
I think that is what that is the crux of it.
Yeah.
Is that there's no getting away from it.
No. So if you sit there with me, you know, like it would be nice. You know, like I'm just imagining, like you're on a couch that would fit two adult bums. So if I'm sitting on that couch in acute grief after Henry died, and you came over and you sat down right next to me, so there's extra space to the right of you, and I'm in between, and you just sat there and put your arm around
me. That's it.
That'd be fucking amazing.
Right.
And that'd be better than you giving me some advice.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
you know, I had a friend who lost a kid.
Great. Okay. All right. Oh, so there's another sad guy out there. All right, okay.
Yeah, it's interesting, because like that is the thing, is that like in order to sort of bear witness or to show up for somebody in that much pain, you know, if you're uncomfortable or even if you're shut down emotionally, that none of that matters in a way.
Yeah.
If you just, you know, share the space.
You know what it's like? Is like if you ever jump off something high into the water, that's fun to do.
Right.
Right. But it's scary.
Sure.
Okay. But you don't really have to do anything. You just kind of have to lean forward.
That's right.
And then in a couple seconds, you'll be in the water. It's kind of like that, comforting a grieving person.
Sure. You just kind of wait till they get done with their crying jag and pat them on the back.
Yeah. You know, and it doesn't take long. Yeah. And it helps tremendously, you know, a couple seconds of touch or silence is the same thing as like falling into some lovely water for them. It helps.
So like most of this, I would imagine. So, you know, when he did pass.
Yeah.
How long did you know that was going to happen?
We learned in September of 2017 that his cancer had returned and would kill him. And then he died in January. On my birthday,
Come
my
on.
41st birthday, Come he died.
On. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so wild, you know?
So you're just waiting in a way.
Yeah.
And trying to maintain some quality of life.
Yeah. And the quality of life is sky high at that point, because although the tumor is growing, he's not showing any symptoms. So we really felt insane, because we know he's got a time bomb in his head and it will kill him as sure as you're born. And
what were the conversations that you were having with your wife or with the other kids? I mean, like, because it seems like, you know, knowing that you don't know when it's going to happen and you have a certain amount of time, how did you emotionally prepare for what was coming?
Well, you can't prepare, right? I remember thinking...
But you can know.
Here's some things I did. So I thought, so I'll be damaged by this. I'll bear scars from this. But how can I protect Henry's brothers?
Yeah.
And because I was worried it would fuck them up irreparably for life. And I called a couple friends from Boston that I loved dearly and that I grew up with.
Yeah.
One of them... His dad died when he was one, and then his mom remarried a wonderful guy who raised him to the age of six, and then he died. So he had his two dads die.
So you're thinking about bringing in another father?
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, can I marry your mother to heal? Is the right thing for me to do to maybe even try to have a baby with my best... No, so, but I called him because he's a wonderful, sensitive guy, and I wanted to know a child who was struck by very severe tragedy, how do I take care of my boys who are about to get walloped? And so I called him, and I called another friend that I grew up with whose brother had died when he was a child, and I said, what do I do to take care of my boys, to both of these guys? And they were like, listen... These things aren't going to define your sons forever. And they're both like, you might fuck up your kids and they might get fucked up, but it won't be this.
Right.
You know, they're like, because both of them were like, you send me pictures of the three of them in Henry's hospital bed. You take Henry with all his beeping machines and tubes to the park. You were constantly holding and touching and loving. So he reassured me. They both reassured me that my wife and I were both doing exactly what we should.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, like, you know, one thing I know just from talking to people and seeing it, that children will become their own people. And they're incredibly resilient. And part of the emotional language they'll learn will process this. And I think ultimately, with the amount of love that you're going to give them, you know, this will... only make them deeper in a sense.
Yeah, they're incredibly emotionally astute. You know, there's no guarantee of a shiny bright future for anybody, but it won't be this.
Right.
So I don't have to fear.
Well, that's something. Right.
And that was really beautiful.
And so, like, leading up to this, so the family intention was just to make the however long he was going to be around as fun or as pleasant as possible.
Exactly. Uh-huh. You know, my wife and I even sat down and wrote out, like, what do we want to do? And we asked the boys, like, what's important for you to do with Henry before he dies? And and because they knew, we told them, you know, they were with us. They were in the next room when we found out that his cancer had come back, and we came out crying. And
oddly, I guess, but naturally, the grieving starts then, in a way.
I suppose so. You know, it's sort of weird. Like, you know, I might have a little more experience with grief than some.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Is that grief? Sure. I'll accept that.
No, I mean, it's the knowing.
Pre-grief.
But it's also like, you know, we all know we're going to die, but we're able to really keep it at bay.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's really one of the driving forces of our lives as sort of selfish, weird, irrational people is the avoidance of that knowledge. Yeah. I mean, there's very few people that I think have that integrated. And there's very few people I think that can, you know, handle that integration because it could go either way. You could sit around and be like, oh, it's the fucking point. You know, I don't want to live, or it's what a ripoff. You know, how do you start to calibrate why life is worth living? And I guess if you have kids, you know, that certainly is one way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess I'm just trying to say that it's difficult for me. I have no children, and I'm depressed a lot.
No, but you know what? I'm looking behind you on the wall is this, like, tapestry type thing.
Yeah.
And I think about the grief that I feel, and let's say that's like, fucking bolt of fabric or string of yarn or whatever. And now that has been, I'm doing the best to weave that into my tapestry, not to try to burn it or throw it off a bridge, but...
Sure.
But I've been given this, and fuck off for 1,000 years if you think I'm not going to weave the death and the life and the spirit of my beautiful son into my tapestry. I mean, what am I, Joni Mitchell at this point? But do you know what I mean? Like,
I don't think you have a choice.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, especially if you're a sensitive person, that, you know, and I think it seems that one of the, one of the reasons.
Yeah.
Why you wrote the book was to sort of kind of, you know, say this is what it is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this is part of life, and this, and I am angry that so many people, you know, make me feel uncomfortable because of their discomfort, and that, you know, that a grown person with a heart that works is going to, you know, understand that this is life. There's no, it's guaranteed. You're born and you're going to die.
Yeah.
And I've had to shoulder this and feel this, and it's going to inform every other part of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the proper way to integrate.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, the fuck you of it is, it's like, you know, your ability now to say, oh, it's coming.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hopefully not for your loved ones, but it's going to come for you.
I know. It is.
But so how did it change your perception in, you know, once you got, like, I imagine the exorcism in writing this book of sort of outside of what we just said in terms of comforting somebody with grief, what are the other issues that you find that you, with other people in terms of how they handled grief that you have a problem with?
Well, I guess it's just very painful gift to receive, but my family received some gifts of profound reality.
Yeah.
And it allowed us to, you know, appreciate how ephemeral even our bodies are.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I guess I also lament, I'm not just frustrated with people who can't hold the grief or feel that they have to babble. I'm not just frustrated with that, but in some ways I feel blessed and burdened with knowledge that they don't yet have about how precious all this stuff is.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll hear them complain about the most pedestrian stuff, and you're like, come on, man.
Yeah.
But you can't really do that, you know, because I'm not cruel.
Right.
I don't want to, you know, drop a bomb in the middle of their day.
You mean, like, at every sort of, you know, kind of a passing social interaction, just say, like, yeah, my kid died.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting. Oh, what was that? Oh, sorry, I was looking over your shoulder at the fucking urn that my son is in on the shelf behind your shoulder.
So tell me about your bad
ingrate.
Breakfast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, but it's all part of the spectrum. So you have to integrate that spite.
Yeah,
and I guess,
and not feel guilty that I feel it. You know what I mean? If my wife and I laugh about some ridiculous thing that somebody said to one of us, then we're happy and we enjoy the rest of our day, and we don't hold on to it hating them. I don't wish these people ill.
No, of course
it's
not.
It's just
and you have to have sort of, there must be some sort of empathy, because the other side of seeing it as, like, it's not a gift, but processing it correctly is.
Yeah.
And it's not something you would wish on anybody.
No, God, no.
So you know, you have to sort of accept the fact. Of course, people don't know how the fuck to behave.
They didn't. Yeah, they haven't been granted they haven't been given the code to access that.
Yeah, thank God. But the bigger message is that, you know, someone grieving is almost everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, to somehow integrate that into how you approach somebody would be a beautiful, empathetic thing to do collectively.
Yeah.
Right?
I know. I'm imagining, because people have the urge to be like, you know, oh, my son has a tumor. Oh, really? Oh, my grandfather had a tumor. It would be a better empathy would be like, oh, my God, your son died.
Yeah.
I'm going to die too, and so are you. Like, that'd be great. Wouldn't that be great?
What, the grandfather thing doesn't work for you?
No. Yeah. But if somebody was like, oh, your son died, and, like, instead of trying to compare, I'm going to die.
Pain. Right.
I'll probably be dead in 30 years. Maybe, I wonder if we'll all be in the same cemetery. Yeah, you know, like, then I'm like, yeah, man, maybe.
But that's also utterly, like, you know, selfish, right? So, like, but I think I think that the real thing that's lacking is, it seems, empathy around it.
Yeah.
That like, because, like, for whatever it's worth, you know, years of talking to people candidly about whatever, and then, you know, having somebody, you know, I loved, you know, basically, you know, die in my house has opened my heart to, like, I can't, like, along with my grief, which I can tap into, but is integrated, that the empathy for it, like, I can feel an almost immediate emotional reaction to someone's loss.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I don't know that I could before.
Yeah, like, I'm having a tough time. you're going to know who, you're going to be like, we really need to get him an omelet. You know what I mean? We don't need to tell him it's going to be okay, but let's get him an omelet. Well, Come on, man.
The thing I have to fight is not to just start crying in front of someone who's experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of like, just sort of like hijack their grief with sort of, but you don't want to commiserate. You want to show up for somebody, right?
Yeah. Totally.
It's tricky, right?
Well, I'm doing that, you know, I have been doing that with my dad because my dad was there when Henry was dying and after he died, and now my dad is dying, and I'm always tempted to talk about, oh yeah, I remember, you know, like when the hospice people delivered my dad's morphine, you know, I was like, oh, your morphine's blue. Yeah, Henry's was red. Yeah. You know, I want to be like, just let him have his death. You know what I mean? So I sometimes will, I'll be like, and then I'll be like, you know what?
Yeah.
Let's just let this guy die for the moment. You know?
I think you seem to have somehow achieved the kind of emotional level of a sort of a death doula in a way.
Maybe.
well, just that, like, you've been able to integrate and accept the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and process the feelings of loss.
Yeah.
You know, you're prepared for it.
Yeah, and preparing for it. I think about my own death.
You do?
And
what do you think about it?
I you know what I try to tell myself is that it'll be fine. You know, it's not my job to know what's going to happen next. But it is.
A lot of people think they know. You have any? It's funny, when I think of my own death, it's sort of like, I have saved some money. I should go over the papers.
Oh yeah,
I mean, you have a family, so it goes to.
Yeah.
I don't, so I'm sort of like, I have some gifts to give.
Totally, that's awesome.
I gotta go over the paperwork.
Yeah. What comes next? I don't know. I think of it like, I'm a glass of water. You're a glass of water. And then we die, we get poured back into the ocean of whatever is out there, and we all mingle. So I'm not me anymore, you're not you anymore, all our molecules are...
We're just part of the big frequencies.
And which is good for me, because I definitely want to be obliterated when I die. I don't want to be me anymore.
Yeah, no, it'd be a relief in a way, wouldn't it? Yeah. But you don't want to go too far with that line of thought.
Yeah,
why not just do it now?
No. Well, I also think, I'm pretty anti-suicide, because I think it's also our responsibility, having been given this life, to ride it out. You know what I mean? Like, I really don't feel like I should decide when life begins or ends, you know, other than, you know, having sex with my wife, which I know could result in a life.
Sure.
You know, I think I should do that.
And when, so you conceived the newest kid while Henry was sick?
We did, yeah.
Consciously,
we did, yeah.
What was the conversation around that?
We wanted a bunch of kids in our house. And we'd thought about having a fourth, but we knew we were so spread so thin between sometimes it was two hospitals and our home, if he was shuttling between the hospital he lived at and the hospital where he got his chemo and three kids. So we knew we couldn't do that. But when we learned he was going to die, we just decided to have another one. It's impossible to replace a child, that can't be done, but we knew that we had a certain amount of love we wanted to be dividing between a bunch of unruly children, and so we wanted our house to be full of little people, and so
it's interesting too, like when you're in that much pain or you're in that much sort of trauma, you know, emotional and mental, you know, I mean, you do things to feel better.
Of course. Yeah.
Like, there's no...
Yeah, you're still allowed to have sex.
Sure. And make more kids.
Yeah.
And how's the new kid?
He's magnificent. He's 4. And
so you have 3 boys?
Yeah. Yeah, no, we have 3 different boys alive.
Yeah.
3 alive boys. And
it's so funny because your tone around Henry and death and, like, the kid died, and it's not a flat affect, but there seems to be a sort of constant reaffirmation of knowing he's dead.
I insist on saying it a lot, mostly for myself.
Yeah.
I repeat to myself the details of his life and appearance of symptoms. Yeah, I tell myself, I'll say, like, I had a boy named Henry, and I loved him so much, and he was healthy and beautiful. And then he got sick, and we didn't know what to do. And we took him to the doctors, and it took a long time. They found out what it was. It was very bad. And they tried to fix it, and they couldn't, and it got worse. And then he died. and now he's dead. And I still love him, and I still talk to him. And he's still my son, and I'm still his dad. And I don't know what our relationship is now. I don't know where he is. But it's very important for me to repeat those things to myself. It grounds me, and it makes me feel not insane.
Yeah. I would imagine that, you know, on top of the act of grief, that as an affirmation,
yeah,
of life in a way, it keeps you present.
Yeah, it does.
Right?
It does. Absolutely.
It's interesting about the, you know, going over that stuff.
It really helps me.
But you know in your heart that you did everything possible.
Oh, yeah.
That's a gift.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're not, my wife and I aren't doctors or nurses, but we know how to love children, and we sure did that. Mm. So,
yeah. And you got all the best care, and it was great.
Oh, yeah.
You know, after the book writing and after the processing, is there one thing that you do now that you didn't?
Yeah. I hold my children and I hold my wife,
yeah,
and I know that they'll die. And I know that it could happen before I die. So I know that our time together is finite and it will end. And so I appreciate them so much more. I marvel at, yeah, the fact that these particular collections of cells coalesced around these souls, mm-hmm, for a temporary period. And I'm so lucky to get to be here at the same time.
Yeah.
As a little collection of cells and whatevers and bones, yeah, and nostril hairs that,
yeah,
I am.
Yeah.
And so I really make the most of it in a way that I didn't before. And I wish that skill didn't come from something so painful, but it did. That was the price tag for me of that gift. And now I have it and I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's beautiful.
It is good.
Yeah. And how do you approach work now?
That's a fantastic question. My opinion and feelings about what I do for a living have sort of changed. Mm. They've become right sized, so to speak.
In that, say in the lingo.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I never, you know how I used to gravitate between, I'm ashamed of what I'm trying to make people laugh as a job. And I'd think, what a piece of shit I am. Or, you know, I'd get a paycheck and an award and be like, I probably deserve it, you know, and it'd be those two things. And now it's gone like zoop, right between the two of those, where I now know that all the accolades and stuff are beyond ridiculous.
Right.
But it also isn't stupid and useless. It's like, it's as important as like the table I'm knocking on here.
Yeah.
You need a table to put your stuff on, and you need a show or a stand-up special at the end of the day to unwind. So it's not more important than any other job in the world, and it isn't less. So now I'm like, I go to work gratefully, and I do the work, and I'm so happy that I get to do
and
it.
And you're busy. I talked to Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, wow.
About the movie.
The Good House.
The Good House, yeah. And that was kind of a dark, interesting part, but very human.
Yeah. And oh, what a privilege to get to work with her, you know. So she's so amazing, of course, but then kind and sensitive and brilliant. And so getting to,
but that character was sort of antithetical to where you're at now.
I know. Yeah. And what a privilege. And they shot it in Nova Scotia, which actually, when I was there a lot, I was having the thought, like, I'd really like to die here. It's so beautiful. I was like, I need to figure out how to die in Nova Scotia. So that movie was a thrill to work on.
And you're doing, what do you got? You're doing Mission Impossible, or you did it?
Yeah, I did a part in that.
Was that a big part?
No, it wasn't. But I did get to do a full week of working with Tom Cruise, which was fascinating.
Was it?
It really was.
Good guy?
To work with, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would want to go on a cross-country trip with him. I mean, he probably doesn't do, I don't think he does things. Like, I didn't get the sense he has a social life. So, yeah, working with him, amazing. Incredibly educational. It's his movies are excellent now all the time, not haphazardly, because he's an unbelievable filmmaker who knows so much. And also Christopher McQuarrie wrote and directed that. So working with the two of them was very educational and great.
You've got any plans of doing any creating?
I'm finishing a script right now that I'll see if anybody wants to make.
For a TV show or a movie?
Probably a movie. Yeah, I started as a TV show, but I think it might actually be a better movie.
Okay.
Because certain things happen in it where it couldn't have subsequent seasons, so why not make it a movie?
Sure.
And then, I've got a show coming out probably in the springtime called Bad Monkey that Bill Lawrence made, which is just tremendous.
Big guy. Did you go shoot that in the States?
Yeah. Shot it in Miami and the Florida Keys.
Hot and muggy.
It was so insanely hot and muggy that it was like,
yeah. Well, he's a good guy. I haven't talked to him in a long time.
He was such a pleasure to work with. Yeah. At first, he was like, do you want to come shoot a show with me in Florida? And I'm like, well, Bill Lawrence, why didn't you have me in your show that you're making in London?
Yeah.
But he's like, which I don't know. Ted Lasso.
Oh.
So I was like, well, I'd love to, but I don't know, you know, Florida, I live in London, I try not to. And he was like, well, why don't I make it family friendly for you, you know, we'll shoot you efficiently, we'll bake in some breaks. And I was like, well, okay, thank you so much, family man Bill Lawrence. So
is that a good part?
So much fun. Yeah. It's based on the book Bad Monkey by Carl Hiaasen.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah.
Which was a great book, and Bill adapted it beautifully and had an incredible time shooting that. So I know I'm in it. Sometimes you do stuff and you're like, yeah, maybe I'll catch that if I get the chance. This one I'm like, can't wait to see.
Oh, good.
Because
it's Vince Vaughn too, right?
Vince Vaughn. Yep. Vince Vaughn, Michelle Monaghan, Jodie Turner Smith, Meredith Hagner, Zach Braff, Scott Glenn.
Wow.
Myself.
Scott Glenn's intense. I talked to that guy.
Yeah. He was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good talking to you, man.
Great talking to you, and great to see you.
It's good to see you, buddy. That was great to talk to Rob. And again, A Heart That Works comes out tomorrow, wherever you get your books. And what a good guy. So look, can you hang out for a second? Just hang out for a minute. If you've got a WTF Plus subscription, you can go back and listen to that early episode with Rob Delaney. That's episode 55. It's really a great talk with a truly harrowing story of what made him get sober. Lipsight has been on a bunch of times, old Sammy. Episode 10, episode 52, episode 162 are all part of the Full Marin, and episode 984 is available in the free feed on all podcast apps. Here, listen to some.
I used to sing in a rock band, so I'm used to a little bit of this.
Yeah, do you feel it coming back to you?
I feel
back when
the surge. I did a thing where I put my whole mouth over the mic and scream into it.
Oh, really? So you made that horrible distorted noise?
Yeah, exactly. And the sound technicians did not like that at all.
That was back in the days of Dung Beetle.
Dung Beetle, yeah.
Was that what it was called?
It was called Dung Beetle, yeah.
You were exploring the freedom.
We were.
Of the form.
We were pushing the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah, for those few people, you pushed the boundaries.
For about 12 people.
But did Dung Beetle ever record?
We recorded a few things here and there, never a full record, but we did some singles and we were on a soundtrack for an independent film, like that.
Oh, really? What film?
It was called Half Cocked, and it came out in the 90s, and it was...
Same 12 people enjoyed that movie?
Do you remember the band, there were a lot of bands that were on the soundtrack, like the Grifters. I don't know if you remember them.
Kind
of. Yeah.
What year are we talking? I'm trying to figure out. When people ask me about music, it's sort of like, was I even doing anything but wandering around doing
comedy? I guess it was mid-90s.
I might have missed the whole... I think I missed most of the 90s.
It's sort of a movie about a fictional band that gets in a van.
Oh, okay.
And goes. And then the filmmakers were in bands, too, and they used songs from friends who were also in bands. And so it was kind of a celebration of a certain moment in... A sad moment, maybe, in American indie rock.
That moment, what is that? It was actually really just a moment. It was about a year.
It was more like 3 seconds.
For some reason in the 90s, I missed everything. Like LCD sound system? I didn't even know they existed.
Well, they didn't exist in the 90s.
They didn't?
No.
When was that?
That James Murphy.
He's a friend of yours,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he is. And he worked with us and with Dung Beetle.
He worked with Dung Beetle?
Yeah.
James Murphy did.
Yeah.
See, that's clickbait right there. That's going to break the
Click
music
away.
Press. Yeah. They're just James Murphy, Dung Beetle connection.
Well,
revealed.
I was just with him the other night, and we were talking
really?
About who... Do we listen to that music, or who even talks about that music?
Which music?
That's just whatever was going
Dung
on.
Beetle?
Dung Beetle, yeah.
You can subscribe to WTF Plus for every episode ad-free. Go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Wait! Before we wrap up today, I need and want to wish Brendan McDonald, my producer, my business partner, my friend, a happy 43rd birthday. 40 fucking 3 years old, Brendan. Brendan, who I started working with when he was 24. We've been working together almost 20 years. This guy has had my voice in his head, and he's become, obviously, one of my dear friends, a guy I respect his opinion of on almost everything, a guy who advises me, a guy who filters me, both on the air and off, somebody who, one of the smartest guys I know and an inspired producer, and I would not be able to do what we do here and what I do in my life without him. Happy birthday, Brendan. You made it another year, 43. You're like a fucking old man now, huh? How's that feel? All right. So my tour dates are winding down. Only three more left this year. My shows at the Orange Peel in Asheville, North Carolina are sold out. Still some tickets for the show in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm at the James K. Polk Center on Saturday, December 3rd. And my HBO special taping is at Town Hall in New York City on Thursday, December 8th. There are a few tickets left for the second show up in the balconies, I think. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. And here's a little a John Lee style.
We'll be right back. Boomer lives. Monkey and La Fonda. Cat angels everywhere. All right.